Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So, we'll just do introductions first. We'll shut the door. That's going. That's it. It's like a squash court, this room, isn't it? Okay. Well, I'm Dan Diamond. I'm a probation operations manager based at Greater Manchester Probation Trust. And I work in the Integrated Gangs Management Unit. If you're familiar with the gangs agencies over the last sort of 10 years, if you are, then you might have heard of an organisation called MAGS. MAGS no longer exists in the city of Manchester, but IGMU is the acronym, Integrated Gangs Management Unit. That is what sort of has taken the place of MAGS. I'm based in the police station where Excalibur Task Force are based. You may have heard, you may not have heard of them as well. And they're a force-wide, if you like, operational policing unit who are tasked to deal with Manchester's gang issues. And they've been around for about 6 years now. But around that unit, we also now have this multidisciplinary team, which includes probation, youth offending service, children's family services, education, trained employment advisor and advocates, women's safety and women's advisory advocate, as well as we've got housing in there, intelligence officer of the police. It's a very sort of multi-agency. It's not an offender management unit, so we don't hold cases. We're an intervention and we assist with the risk assessment and risk management process. That's kind of where I'm based.
My name is Wayne Ryan. I'm a probation officer based at the Intensive Alternative to Custody. It's centre of Greater Manchester. What we deal with is 18 to 25 year old adult males who are at risk of short term custody, so that's 12 months or longer. It's diverting away from short custody. Because what the evidence shows is that people who've got short term custody reoffend, I think 75% of them reoffend within 2 years here. So it's diverting them away from short custody. Like Dan's team, it's a multi-agency team, so it's probation, which is me, education, training, employment, drugs workers, housing. We have outreach workers who do out-of-hours visits to people, manage risk, that kind of thing, police as well. I think that I've got them all there.
Okay.
That's about it. Education as well. That's me. And I'm also an RJ facilitator, so I know about the RJ bit to this presentation. And I think we and Dan have discussed this quite a bit and put this together, and what we thought is there is a bit in terms of context setting, in terms of the bit that Dan's going to do, but then it's about throwing out some questions in terms of RJ and how RJ is delivered, you know, in terms of tackling gangs and people who are gang flagged. But I think we thought it was useful to sort of like get some context about gangs and people who are flagged as gang members.
Yeah, okay. Can I, there's only a few in here, so it'd be helpful just to very quickly get a sense of sort of the background of the audience room, if you like, or the group. Let's call it a group now. So just yourself.
My name's Kate. I'm from a charity called Construction Youth Trust. Help young people make a start in the construction industry, and right. We do a lot of work with gangs and other youth justice.
Okay, brilliant. Okay.
I'm Lorraine. I run this thing at Central St Martins, which is an art school called Design Against Crime, and one of our initiatives is called Design Against Gang Crime.
Right.
Art Against Knives as well.
I'm Bill Cousin with the Justice Board, and I lead our Mission on Justice and Gangs.
Happy to hear from you, so thanks for mentioning it again.
My name is Gilberto Alvaro from Kent Community Foundation, and specifically from a fund called the Overstone Fund, which focuses as one of its main funding streams on charities that help reduce crime and reoffending rates in the UK. So obviously this is interesting to us.
And then Graham Robin, my other interest for coming this afternoon is that I've been part of the Home Office and again as far as peer review series. Yeah. And so I'm really interested in how I can work with that for this experience.
Yeah. Okay. Just to explain, this isn't an excuse or a quick get out. I was invited at the very last minute to do this workshop. Nevertheless, those who will know me know I'm never short of a thing to say. I was very quiet in there because I was stumped on most of that. It's not my arena, so, which didn't do me any harm to shut up for a few hours. But in terms of this particular area, there is for me some, if you like, an elephant in the room. And it's an important one to sort of give a quick kick, if you like, just so we know it's there. And that is the issue of the word gang itself and the term gang and its use as a reference point for what is, if you like, a quite a popular topic, both in the media, both in policy, government, and also a popular topic that attracts funding. Graham mentioned before, you know, he and I have been our peer reviewers for the End of Gang and Youth Violence programme, which has been led by the Home Office. And I take issue before with something that was said from the panel by the chap from the victims, Mr. Khan. just in terms of about the third sector only being incentivised by a desire to assist, there's an absolute bun fight going out there for funding. When the government sort of rolled out the End of Gang and Youth Violence agenda and made what £11 million roughly, wasn't it, available? What people didn't know about gangs was on a postage stamp. It was unbelievable. So, and I'm not being irreverent now. I'm just saying that there's a lot out there going on, and the word itself has been very much like some of the comments around RJ. It's been sort of twisted and turned and made into different shapes to suit different agendas. And it's quite a dangerous one in our world because, of course, the word gang itself can mean a whole host of different things in the risk paradigm. So that, in the spirit of that, really. Now, what we were going to do is sort of split you down. In fact, we've got two groups of three here, you know. We could just, two groups of four, even. We could still do this. What do you think? I just want to discuss that for a few minutes, together, and then we'll feed back, if that's all right. So I'll join you. You can join them. Is that okay? Just have a mutter. Or if you want, we could all do it together, or whatever. What do you think? Look, that's fine then. That's fine. We're all kind of feeling a bit lazy now anyway, so they don't want to pressure out. Yeah, okay. So, what do we mean by this term?
Well, it's the media term, isn't it? If you look at the riots, when there was the prediction that it was a gang-related event through Dr. Luke's case, it has a sort of history that's linked to sort of sensational reportage. Okay. So, there are gangs, and there have always been gangs, but that's a denotation of a group of people that work together. The connotation is very serious. It's about organised crime.
Okay, so some of it's about organised crime. It's a media term, yeah? Any other thoughts?
I mean, to me, it was never really a bad thing straight away. For me, a gang is just a group of people, basically. But, you know, when you get gang now, you know, that is used pejoratively to denote that group of people is probably engaging in crime, and they don't actually need to have done that in the first place, I've noticed, to be classed in that way. You know, you can say there's a gang of police, for example, and you know, the implication is that they will at some point commit a crime, and so they'll be seen as a threat of some form, and so it's very it's a very charged word.
So it's quite negative now, the term. It used to be it's a group of people, now it's quite negative.
It's black crime. It's black crime. There's a lot of the time gang crime is presented in terms of ritual. You know, you'll see gang crime, tribal, you'll see a whole range of different connotations. And that, I found that quite a problem with the own term, our own initiative, because it's got the word gang in it, and I preferred Design Against Youth Violence because that's always what we were looking at. But actually, Dave got outvoted, so.
The term is so readily used. I remember, and you're right, who mentioned the civil disturbances last year? Was it? You mentioned it before. Right, pointing at what you're looking at then. I remember watching some the Parliament Channel just for 10 minutes during lunchtime, right in the wake of this, and the word gang was dripping from the politicians' lips like a waterfall. The word gang was in every other sentence, and I was aghast at it. And I'm not being smart pants here, but if you'd have waltzed into that room and just froze time for a second and asked them, can you just clarify what you mean by gang? I doubt you'd have received a particularly descriptive or a really academic description. You'd have heard the usual pejorative references, you'd have heard the assumptions.
Certainly to receive a single comment.
Excuse me?
Certainly to receive a comment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And there's a self-fulfilling prophecy element to it, as we know. Kids will now say, I'm in a gang, because they've worried if they're not in a gang.
Gang speak, they call it, don't they? Gang speak. And it's this kind of terminology that's used to establish a norm that this is the reality for people. And very often it might not be. And it's terminology used by academics, but they criticise it, but it's also used by law enforcement agencies, community groups, the young people themselves who feel like it's obligated to define that. And there's lots of reasons why they might do that, and lots of reasons that aren't necessarily that consistent. But the reality of it is, I think, and from my experience working in this arena for several years now, is that it's a very complicated word because it draws all difficulties around assessing individuals and trying to understand what they are about. And if you like, in the risk paradigm, the word gang is worth at least 50 points, whatever 50 points is. But it's just the word itself, never mind anything else. It sort of sends a few, it gets people's attention. So as soon as somebody says the word gang, boom. And this is going on all the time. I'm frequently involved in, if you like, email battles between various offender managers or probation delivery units who are disputing whether somebody should be transferred into an area because all hell's going to break loose because of gang wars. I was talking to some police a few years ago, and they'd visited Los Angeles, and I don't know why. Well, anyway, they did. Complete waste of time, probably. But they did, and they were talking about the mayor of LA who had gone on the news and was in the wake of an increase in gang tensions and gang activity, which, of course, we're talking about a whole different world over there in that regard. And his statement was, he was in his manifesto, "I'm declaring war on LA's gangs." Okay, so that in itself is a, if you like, a petition to battle. The other day, I received this just from our library. It was Manchester Evening News, 11th of January. Police Commissioner Tony Lloyd steps up war on Manchester gangs. As 12 arrests and dawn raids. Now, I'm sure those raids were really useful, and I'm sure those individuals that selected needed to be, you know, identified and arrested, and all the bits and pieces whipped off them is worth having. However, it's just the way things are talked about, the way it's reported, and there's that term again. And there's a real desire to use that reference to push forward political sort of muscle, if you like. So it's just, if you like, at this point, to almost to turn it upside down, just slow it down a little bit, pause it. So the assumption here is this workshop is simply about restorative approaches in tackling gangs. And actually, I'm not even sure if we're there. I know that we're going to talk a little bit about that, and I'm interested in what you guys have got to say about this. I'm not sure what your experience has been from the ending gang files peer reviews, but mine, I've not seen a great deal, I've seen smatterings of it. North of the border, they're defining all violence as a public health issue, as a disease, you know, and that's gaining traction. And I've asked, how does that play out in restorative justice? And I've not really heard a great answer yet about that. So there's lots of different agendas at play in wrestling with the issue itself. Okay, so I want to head a little bit here. So just to point out or underline what I've just said. So when you're working on that basis, you can imagine it is a complicated business, and I I just want to, I guess, establish that right from the outset, so that as we talk through this, there are no givens, there are no absolute assurances of the individuals that we're talking about, whether they go to a school, whether they're in a prison, whether they're just community members or offenders of the worst type, whether or not they are actually in a gang or not. That again is a hotly disputed issue. This is not to say there are no such things as gangs, and on that basis it's important that there is a definition, and there are a number of definitions out there. The government have opted to draw upon the dying to belong definition, which is this. So, a relatively durable, predominantly street-based group of young people. I debate the word young, but then I suppose if you're 40, everyone above, then, you know, anyone in their 20s is young. But if you talk about young people, generally, people are talking under 18 very often. But in Manchester, we're still dealing with people in their 30s who are entrenched in a gang lifestyle. And so, this doesn't quite fit it that way. We're not going to moan too much. See themselves or seen by others as a discernible group. Engage in a range of criminal activity and violence. Identify with or lay claim over territory. Have some form of identifying structural feature and in conflict with other similar gangs. Any thoughts on that? Does that resonate? Does that make sense? Is that helpful?
Is that similar to what people would have thought? Definition of a gang was all slight differences or something that you thought may have been in there that isn't?
You know, it's the definition of subculture too. So if you're a crazy gang, which is a happy gang, you know, are you saying, just like the word gay is rarely used to talk about being jolly, are you talking about the fact that the word now has no other meaning apart from that?
No, of course not. And I suppose we're defining here an urban street gang, which is what generally the comments are about. There are serious organised crime groups. But if you like, the common reference that we'll hear in the media is very much describing this phenomenon. So it's an urban street gang, but where the tension lies is the peer group as well, because what sits underneath that is your antisocial groups of young people. I say antisocial, they might commit antisocial behaviour, they might be generally okay, but are quickly labelled gang when that group are involved in some form of criminality or antisocial behaviour. The local press, I was interested what someone said there about, the local press is often more friendly or more people respect or believe it more. And actually, the local press where I live are pretty ruthless. But Manchester Evening News has dined out on the gang issue really well. You know, they've made a lot of money. Other types of criminality, you know, it's interesting. But gangs, they frequently like to talk about them. So, but I guess the key bit there is criminal activity as well, you know, and violence. Okay, so now just to make things a bit more complicated, and this is of interest to me, they've revised the definition already, and they're not changed that, they're not taking any of those lines out. They've added something to it. I don't know if you know this ACOP's done this recently, and so you'll see it coming up there. There you go, and or. Now that is the most problematic and or I've ever read in my life. I've wrestled with this and bored people senseless talking about it. But just to sort of to explain why. So if you take the first three, so if what we're saying now is that a gang is the first three and the other three, all the other three. So the first three can stand alone, and local agencies now have legitimacy with reference to this to say that that's a gang. Can you see any problem with that? Essentially, the first three points probably describe a vast amount of youth crime, but not necessarily would it be captured under the term gang if you were then going to compare it to the next three. Sometimes I'll argue with people and suggest that arguing whether someone is in a gang or not is a red herring. What you really need to be doing is looking at the risk factors and deciding from the risk factors what you're dealing with and what kind of an issue is presenting through the assessment. In our world, if you like, laying claim over territory and being in conflict with other gangs is a significant aspect of that. Why do you think that might be the case? Why would that make all the difference?
If you go back into history, the Shoplifting Gang from the 40s, the geographical determinism is irrelevant. They come from many places that arrive in South London. They're not defending a territory, they're doing something else. Mm-hmm. They don't fit all those definitions. So it's about making it very specific, about specific.
Yeah. Okay. So it's but yeah, it's leading to a territory. Why might it make? What might be the risk implications for that? So assessing risk. If you look at the first three, okay, there are a group of villains going around committing various forms of violence and criminality. So what? Why are we calling them a gang? What makes that any different?
It's the definition of a nation state, isn't it? Like committing war over territory. So, I mean, it's quite a political implication on resources.
Okay, yeah, it can be. But if I talk about risk factors for somebody who's in a gang, then territory is going to be a huge part of their risk factors, isn't it? Because if somebody comes in and says, look, Wayne, I'm all right being on probation, but I can't actually come to your office because it's right smack bang in the middle of the dump, a certain area, what they would regard as rival territory. And it may well be absolutely the case. Some years ago, I used to supervise a lad, many years ago, who used to, and I didn't realise at the time, the extent of his involvement. And he used to arrive at the office absolutely out of breath every week, and sometimes looking a bit worse for wear. I realised what was going on was he lived in another area, would had to run through, unless he did an enormous detour around, run through the rival territory to get to the office. And it was like running the gauntlet. And yet I'd walk to the shop and I wouldn't see a thing, it wouldn't matter. But he stuck out like a sore thumb because rivals would see him. And so the territory issue, therefore, that does present to us a big issue, because when people are in territory, it shouldn't be. That's when the violence, significant violence for violence sake, is often committed. And the last one, the conflict with similar gangs. If the first three are in conflict with similar gangs, then you're not dealing with rivalry. You're not dealing with... And that again, you know, if you think about someone reporting to a community centre or to a probation centre or going to a library or going to a college, if there are rival gang members in that locality, then it presents a whole load of things to manage, and they are actually really dangerous. But if they're not there, if those things aren't there, then we're dealing with something quite different. So you can see how the additional elements of this definition, as they progress through them, it can become a real kind of a complicated affair when we're trying to assess them, or it's nothing at all. So, just moving it on a bit there. That line there, the authors conclude that the uncritical and arbitrary employment of the gang label, and this is what I'm edging towards, it's this idea that it's just used so frequently. Now this isn't in relation to a study in the northwest, a certain borough in the northwest where Asian, if you like, Asian groups of young men were being labelled as gang members. And so quite a significant piece of research was done to look at that, and what this was sort of just one tiny bit of their comments about that whole issue. Okay, that's the article there. There's only a few slides, so I'm going to wrap it up shortly. I won't read this one, but again, it's about definitions, just a bit in black. If this definition is used to identify gangs within a certain area, it will produce more gangs. The definitions that specify further defining features, so the more narrow, the limited sort of number of criteria, the more broader and sweeping. So that, as I showed you before, the first three points of a definition could just describe tons and tons of people as gang members. and then all that comes with that currency. So, okay. But there is a, there's an appetite for this. So waging turf wars with knives and belts is a nice newspaper headline. This, the date, 1870. This is Manchester, this. We love our gangs, don't we? Okay. A new study, The Scuttlers of Victorian Manchester, reveals that gang culture dates back almost 140 years. This is the work of Andrew Davis. It's an interesting book. But yeah. Just of note, and I, when I saw the lecture on this, I did find this quite interesting. These chaps did have an identity. They wore cravats, they wore clogs, they wore belts with big buckles. The buckles we used to whack people with, that was their kind of weapon, if you like. And they used to wear caps that they kept down, pulled over their heads, but they'd lift the cap up, they'd let the cap show their hair. If you notice, the hair's notched a bit at the front, it's a bit missing. And that was their kind of hairstyle to indicate their allegiance as a Scuttler and a certain gang. So, you know, I'm just throwing that up there as a, just a point of interest, really, just to play around with the fact that it's not new and it has been going on for a long time. He talks about the Glaswegian gangs as well, the 1920s and in the 1920s and 30s, and back then the press in Glasgow were comparing to the Chicago gangs of the day. So there's this kind of real appetite to sensationalise, and if you look at that, it just wasn't the same thing at all. Okay. But in Manchester, like I said, they like to whack out these campaigns and politicians, as guilty. That there was Colin Joyce, who received 39 years for the murder of Hugh Kelchin and Tyrone Gilbert. And the police put a campaign out like a poster display right across the city of the convictions, and that's him his aged appearance of when he would be released. And these were enormous billboards, if you like, the size of that wall, that it was bigger, you know, and they were all through the
city centre,
right through the middle of Moss Side. It caused, even though it was a very successful conviction, we were very glad to see the back of these individuals in terms of crime. It was quite a controversial tactic to employ because it fed into, if you like, the perception issue. And the local authority weren't too chuffed either. So I'm not quite. I'd like to be in the fly on the wall in the safety partnership meetings when that had happened, just to hear what the chiefs were saying about it. But it, you know, nevertheless, it was arguably justified to a large extent. But yeah, just this continuing sort of pushing of the idea of gangs. Okay, so. One of the issues that we look at, and I'll hand some time to Wayne shortly, but is this idea of well, what does that mean then? If someone's in a gang, what of it? What is its value in our perception of that person? What does that mean to them? And so one of the things that we've looked at is this idea of the gang being an enabling feature. So does the gang, their association to a gang, does it enable their offending? Does it give them access? Does it increase their risk? Sometimes it just doesn't. Sometimes it's a label we've given them, and actually the gang issue is secondary to the criminality. It's sometimes a screen that we use. It might give them some access. But there are those cases, though, where there is a significant feature of their criminality. So it's just having an understanding of that and see how that plays in their offending experience. Okay. So part of the End Gang Youth Violence initiative, Wayne runs a small project group and they apply for some funding to do the pilot amongst the...
Yeah, under the Ending Gang Youth Violence, I'm leading on four work streams. And one of those work streams, in terms of restorative justice, is a bit of research undertaken by independent academic research studies. Theo Gavridis, he's quite forward in restorative justice. What we've asked them to do is look at restorative approaches in terms of gang and youth violence. So tackling that, how do RJ with people who are flagged as gang members or have committed youth violence offences? Now that research is ongoing, but part of what we thought today is looking at getting the context as Dan has done in terms of gangs, understanding what gangs are, what gang members are, the definition, then thrown out to yourselves and having some sort of discussion about the difficulties in terms of possibly doing restorative justice conferences with the sort of young people that we've looked at before. What could be the difficulties? Would you have to do it slightly different to any other RJ conference, say for a bird one? Would your approach be different? Dan talked about some of the risk factors going into different areas, yeah, meeting different people. Those sort of things come into RJ conferences are risk assessed. What do you have to take your risk assessment to a higher level because you're dealing with serious youth violence?
Is it about just the risk assessment, or is it about that when you bring two groups together for a conference, there are experience of empathy. But if somebody has been in a group that has enabled them to use the group as a family almost, surely that how you debrief them or how you create those empathetic experiences might have to be more sustained over a longer term rather than the simplistic account, just one conference that works. I mean, I found that slightly troubling.
I made that point earlier on, just to say that very often when we talk about RJs, and excuse my ignorance here, because like I say, I'm not cited as heavily on this agenda as many of the people here. However, it's often presented as a one-to-one kind of relationship, or this very, quite a singular event. I'm not saying that's what it is, and I've heard today quite a lot more, but that's kind of the face of it. And so when you think about that in this context, it feels very different, and it feels like potentially quite problematic. So.
Well, one of the things that I heard in one of the last presentations was conflict, and that's what we talked about in those six things in terms of identifying gang conflict. It's much harder to deal with than an actual offence here. Burglary offence, we talked about conflict with families, we talked about troubled families, conflict with neighbours. They're much more difficult to get over with, and these conflicts could be at an even higher level. And those sorts of things. And then the question is, out here, how then do we start to work with that and engage with that and get some sort of restorative conference if we can?
One of the questions that was raised for me by a detective who became an RJ practitioner was his account of might we work with prolific offenders. But, if you take burglary, so I work with Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science, you look at Ken Peace's work on burglars and families of burglars, they are not a gang, they're a family. And for some gang members, the gang is the family. Like, is it as straightforward as, presenting the opportunity to experience it from the victim's point of view that brings the change moment? And I think that, if you're an opportunistically young, I can see how it's a wonderful process. But I also saw the proxy stuff where you go into prison and, if you haven't managed to meet with your own offender, that you speak with other offenders who've spent time. I can see that being a really valuable process, but it seems to me to be slightly dismissed by the first speaker of the victim support as a sort of lesser thing. But it seemed to me that maybe that a multiplicit approach to delivering RJs is useful, and that I would imagine that gang crime, because of all those connotations I've mentioned, perhaps requires a...
That's a really good point, that. This puts the word a proxy or vicarious sort of experience. We were talking, is anyone here familiar with Sycamore? I'm not overly familiar, but every night I guess somebody comes, one of the defender managers will talk to me, and I was talking today about a case of theirs, just reviewing it, and they were telling me about this particular safety program where a number of victims came in, spoke to the group, and they were all robbers, so street robbers, so violent robberies, and the impact was massive on this individual. The offender just sat there, like, quite crumpled by the accounts of these several individuals.
I think you made a comment earlier this morning that there's a lot of evidence around to support these sorts of programmes. It's just not of the same order of quality given so far as some of the other stuff. And I think that's the challenge of how we get really good evidence to say the long term impact of things like Sycamore Tree and the way we have got evidence.
I have seen quite a lot of evidence. The Cares Foundation produced on actual offenders. You know, the evidence about recidivism rate, and also because I do evaluation on my own work with the Giordano Institute, I'm quite aware of how experimental evaluation is and how problematic it is. So, like, I advise the Home Office, and I know they're very, you know, concerned to see the evidence. But actually, their own CCTV program in Britain was never implemented on that sort of evidence. So I have real issues. We always go back to this old frigging chestnut, which is where's the evaluation, where's the evidence? You know, and so that about, I mean, it just seems to me that the scale of the argument is completely different. It's about, you know, a different experience of offender, I suppose, different types of offenders. And that, I don't, you know, I feel like it's a bit religious, so we should all go, yeah, you know, we've found our gen, it's all perfect. It isn't, it's complicated.
Yeah, I'm not hearing that today, though. I think I've heard today, from what I'm seeing as sort of coming into this level, listening to these individuals, it is quite complex. But I think there also is this, there is, in some of the agencies, a tendency to try and simplify it so it will fit an existing structure, and that's not going to happen.
Well, I have no problem. It's going to be better than what people had so far. Mm. I mean, this approach must produce something new, so I can be against it. But I've just been a bit disappointed because it's presented as, you know, this one thing that happens. And empathy and the development of empathy is very complex. And that's why we have the notion of psychopaths. You know, but actually, half the people defined as psychopaths might not be, because later they develop other qualities. You mentioned sex offenders. That's a very interesting case. But, like, to go back to, like, how do you work with gang members then, using RJ? That was just...
Can I come in from your last question earlier on about what I'd seen in the business?
Yes, sorry, yeah.
I'm thinking about that. I want to come back to your point. The only ones that really stick in mind were the work that's been done in primary schools. And it was on the hope.
That's interesting.
There's no more than that. That if you teach the skills to the youngsters in primary schools about conflict resolution, then in due course it will have an impact when conflict happens. Well, and we're in the same discussion again there. You know, there's some good ideas to work on in schools, as we know, but you know, how has that impacted on the sort of conflict we're talking about? And we've got an answer to that. But that's the only.
And that's very much on the preventative agenda, isn't it? And so, and on the preventative agenda with young people, you're looking at building resilience, aren't you? It's not just about empathy, in natural sort of day-to-day life experiences, but we're building resilience. And we in Manchester, we've got various programmes that are looking at targeting very young children, which that in itself is quite controversial, because you could argue it's labelling them. But, you know, we will be criticised for that. But regardless of that, those who are identified at risk have been targeted and worked with, and to, if you like, to stem them away from that. And that's very much that softer. We don't talk about gangs in that sort of situation, but we just talk about the issues around it.
Like. The evidence is usually the recidivism rates are my mistake. You know, in terms of RJ, most of the evidence that's mobilised is about, you know, it's about offending again. Whereas, like, Geese Theatre, the Clean Breakthroughs, there's loads of them from the CARES Foundation. They argue that those processes reduce recidivism, and they have very good evidence. So when you say the proxy stuff doesn't have the evidence,
I haven't said that.
Sorry, I think you did, but I've read quite a lot that does have that evidence. It's just usually dismissed.
I think there are lots of interventions around gang offenders, okay? Now, we're not necessarily looking at that right now. We are involved in Manchester in all sorts of stuff, but they're not RJ initiatives. And I think this is where Wayne's work is trying to sort of tread some of that territory at the moment. Because nationally, and as I referred to, and thanks for that there, it's actually quite untrodden territory. So it's a bit, to come here to discuss this, we're not at all sitting here to say, yeah, go away. There's your package of intervention with RJ and gangs. It's not a quick fix at all, or a neat fit, or a quick fix. Sorry.
It's an area of practice that we've started to look at, and other people may face in their areas of work, and it's putting that out there, and how can it be tackled? Is there any work that we're doing, or other people may be doing, that can help to sort of like put a structure of RJ in for gang offenders, and working with them in that way?
I think possibly one of the issues is that, as with most new initiatives for dealing with problems, you've got an idea that you you've developed it, now you need to sort of confront people with it and go, like, would you like to come into a social justice conference of some form or another with a victim or with, you know, I don't know exactly what the plan is, but possibly a rival gang member or something like that. But who knows? But I think what came to mind was a programme that I read about from 1995 in Belfast, and they dealt with joyriders.
All right.
Heard about this one?
Yes.
Do you remember the methods they used to engage them? They used methods whereby they went to the gangs, if you want to label them as that, yeah. And they would, you know, they would be there at 1 a.m. while they were joyriding. They wouldn't start talking to them about, hey, have you ever considered not doing this? They would start talking to them about what they did. They would slowly get themselves accepted. They would open bars late and make sure that they were available to chat to the people until eventually they sort of came around to it. And I think possibly it's getting that entry point first where they actually start to build up a bit of trust in the practitioners,
yeah.
And then saying, what have you thought about restorative justice? So it's not saying, sorry, it's not really commenting on anything on how you can
itself.
It's just points leading up to it. It might help.
I read this account in Guardian, gangbanger had been shot in the head and into prison and still not repented.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to use the word repent. And what happened is he went on a sort of a trip abroad to Gambia, and he sort of saw, you know, real disadvantage, and it changed his perception. But it seems to me that when we talk about restorative justice, we're talking about a tool that enables the change of perception. But it's obvious that there are different experiences of embeddedness.
Mm.
And so I think the point that you just made about the long build-up to it actually has
quite
value in that.
Okay.
I think some of the interventions that we do use in terms of different programs helps with that build-up, and that's a sense of trust with the worker, where the worker can get to a stage where they can start to approach something like RJ, the legal person. And as well, age, people getting older, that was saying about, you know, mid to late 20s, people start to desist them.
The whole desistance theory agenda has not been mentioned today, but that's quite an interesting part. Desistance, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Any comments on what's been said so far? I know it's kind of a bit jumbled, this, but we kind of came at this, look, I'm not absolutely sure on ourselves, because as I've referred a couple of times, there is no absolute established practice with RJ that's played out in gangs, and part of the reason for that is because literally the issue of gangs itself is quite complicated, a bit contradictory. I'm just interested, Kate, in some of your experiences, because you getting people into building and working and employment. You mentioned gangs when you didn't. You know, how does that play out in your sort of experiences?
Well, it's sort of similar to what you say about locations,
right?
Certain kids coming from schools that are in their own territory, and we've had young kids, 16-year-olds, having to sort of run off course from someone's hospital in their own territory. But I don't have any experience talking about restorative justice at all. So I'm just curious about what kind of response you've had so far. I guess it's still early days,
or trying
to gain trust.
As I say, the research is ongoing, which will be completed by the end of March. I'm not sure from my experience that there is much else going on in terms of RJ and gangs, and it may be a piece of developing practice that starts to come along. A couple of people have said they've got some involvement with the gangs agenda, whether working with gang members or having leads for gangs and that kind of thing. So maybe a piece of work that starts to come on stream sometime later on. But it's just to put it out there and start to think about it. Because today nothing's really been mentioned apart from this workshop about gangs. You know, a lot of the RJ stuff has been, for a better way, fairly safe. You know, we could do RJ and some of the problems in funding and resources, that kind of thing, and getting it done. But this is a more sort of complex and difficult piece of work where we've not really approached it yet. And that may well.
That sort of leads perhaps into the point I want to make is, well, what actually is he trying to achieve with RJ in the campaigns? Is it their desistance
or actually, is it all about the victim?
Yeah, that's a really valid question.
And if it's all about the victim, then actually, does it really matter?
But who's the victim?
We're not actually impacting the persistence of that.
Very often, the victim of the gang offence is a rival gang member. So that's quite a...
But it may not be.
No, of course it may not be. And equally, they're very often convicted of very violent offences against members of the public. But the shooting offences and the sort of the hard end of the violence are very often targeting one another.
Inspection of our chain. Mm-hmm. I came to Great Manchester. I took some colleagues, actually. They're all over to go. This isn't an observation so much about Great Manchester, but it is a broader observation about some of the other probation trusts that I visited, is that they saw RJ solely in terms of impact on offending.
Yeah, I've made that note here about that.
Didn't actually quite get the victim perspective, and that was as important, maybe more important, probably.
Yeah.
But that's not our business.
These are points that I've been thinking as I've been listening, how that plays out, especially when you look at crime sort of targets, and therefore who do you do this type of intervention with, and that's often led by the priority of targeting rather than the priority of the victim groups, and that's a real tension in the discussion.
Some of the gang members are victims too, mm-hmm. because they're violent. So take Bulgarian and Romanian pickpockets. Mm-hmm. And the British Transport Police is a count of that some of the women who are trafficked, basically they're paying off dowries, pickpocketing, mm-hmm. and dipping, because they actually have to pay the money back. So it's really hard with some of the police officers. It's like a conveyor belt, in and out.
There's a statement made by John Pitts, who at the moment is doing some work around young women violent gangs for the government, based at Bedfordshire University, but there's a statement, I'll just paraphrase it, I'm not going to get that quote, but it's in his book called The Reluctant Gangster, and he says basically the very same issues that are a consequence of gang involvement are also a cause of gang involvement. So if you like, you blame all these poor outcomes because they've got involved in gangs, but actually the poor outcomes made them susceptible to going into a gang. And so what that's doing is sort of separating the issue. It's putting the responsibility back onto the experience of that young person. So that Skelmersdale stuff there, which was quite interesting, that sort of saying, look, right at the outset, we're modelling appropriate behaviours, you know, we're teaching them by our behaviour ourselves. We're not just going to blame the fact that they've got involved in this criminal group for the poor outcomes in their life. And so it kind of hits that at both ends, really. Okay, I mean, and again, you know, how do you manage pure RJ with some of these issues and where the victim is a gang member? Or if you look at, for example, Manchester's gang profile, and it's not the same as some London gangs are like this, but vastly aren't like this, is that they are family deep. So you've got sort of second generation, you've got young men on the streets whose dads were murdered in gang wars in the 1980s, and they're dining out on that still, and still acting and limping for those wounds. And so when you bring someone like that into an RJ context, their whole experience has been characterised by this just neighbourhood labelling, sort of matter. And it's very difficult, you know. And again, lay on top of that, in Manchester, again, I'll use Manchester as an example here, 90% of those who've been identified as gang nominals are from a black minority ethnic background. That's again another elephant in the room, because why is that? That's that in itself, so we can rage all night about that. But you know, so bringing a young black person. So if you look, for example, there's these gang callings that they're using. That's a bit of a restorative justice type process. I went to Scotland a few months ago with one of the police in my department, and we listened to the Glasgow experience of the gang calling, and it was fascinating. But I just said to, I turned and said to my colleague, "Can you imagine that in Manchester? 30 black boys in a courtroom being shouted at by all the white police and the white magistrates in the court. And that's the very cheap and low down base of it, but actually that is the reality. The reality would be, I can only begin to imagine what the media would make or something like that. And it's probably not worrying because we're not at that level, we're no longer in that place. But race is a huge part of that. So in terms of RJ, engaging people, there's so many things in the background that are going on with this offender group or this community group, if you like. So not all convicted offenders are labelled as gang members. So it's a complex. And I'm asking those questions here of you. I'm asking this conference, and the room's bigger and more people here. People involved in criminal justice, maybe, and other sectors, we might have a different discussion, but I'm just, these are sort of the things I'm raising and that Wayne and I have identified. We've got a small case study. It sort of occurred to me last night to share this. Community Against Gangs, Guns and Knives, CAGAG, one of them, an acronym, initiative. And we had a huge sort of engagement activity at the Etihad Stadium where that team played on the other side of town. But there was many people, and he showed this, and I asked, could I have a copy of it? I'll just play the first sort of 15 seconds of it, and I'll just ask you a question, and then we'll watch the rest of it, and then I'll tell you the outcome. Okay. It's playing on a mobile phone. Very poor. Okay, what do you see?
It's been a hassle, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. What else? Anything else? What have you observed so far?
Single girls and two boys.
Okay. Is it a gang?
Could be other people from my class at school.
Yeah.
So I've
okay, yeah, yeah. There's no rights and wrongs. I'm just interested in what your observations are. Okay. So I'll play it out. It's quite disturbing to watch that first, just because it's just it's young people just being horrible, isn't it, and violent. I didn't warn you of it just simply because I wanted to sort of you to see it, and then sort of we can talk about it. Are there any views on that? What you've just seen? Any thoughts? Any impressions? You can comment on before we move on.
Was that someone at the end coming in to stop her?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think she tottered off on her own.
Right, okay. The person that's slightly older, the one who sort of came and stood next to her.
Right, and sent up a little bit.
Someone obviously needed her in there while that was happening, so
yeah.
I don't know how effective she was, but, you know, I wonder, was that, but I'm just
the
asking.
The girl stood in front of her was intimidating her.
Yeah.
She made her kneel down.
Oh, right, yeah, because, yeah.
Yeah.
against the girls and the girls.
Yeah.
Did you work out why they were?
I'll tell you about it now, and I was fascinated by this, and it's not a good ending, sort of, end of day like, on a miserable thing like this. One of the things that I heard someone say something recently, and it struck me, and I've never thought of it before, but when we talk about interventions with gangs, people go on about all their bespoke approaches to this particular issue, and but when it comes down to it, what ends up happening, you just end up with the gang member yourself on your own with them, just doing one-to-one work, or they might be involved in the group, but the group will be part of something else. It might be a working group, or it might be a team, a football team, something like that. But whatever intervention or change agent you're using, it's not necessarily targeted at the gang, it's targeted at the individual, yet the gang is the dynamic you're actually wrestling with. I know it's made up of individual thinkers and agents, but they're buying into a group dynamic. And so the question posed was, why are we not dealing with the group? Why are we not bringing the group together? Now that presents, you know, and we've got a group going on at the moment in Manchester, actually, called the G2Me. We're piloting it at the IAC. It's being run by a third sector group. We are having a bash at this, bringing known gang nominals together who have been significant offenders. They're not peripheral players. They've been managed in the criminal justice system at a very high level, firearms offences and all sorts of significant crimes. But this actual idea of approaching the group. Now, in that incident, what happened? The mobile phone footage fell into the possession of the police because. In relation to another incident, so the police got hold of this phone and in relation to another offence about 4 months later after that. So that incident gone unreported. The girl who the victim of that had not mentioned it to anybody, and so the police, of course, upon finding this, immediately identified and worked out who it was and where it was and went to the school with it. And then the young woman who was the victim, turns out she's a, and this makes it all the more sad for me in a way, but she's a child carer for a dad. She was going home and the mum's not around, and she cares for a dad who's ill, and so she never mentioned it to him because she didn't want to stress him out. I mean, you could have picked up probably a more unwilling victim. Yeah. So of course, when the police got the handle of this, they approached the school, and then I guess what took place after that. Now, I'm not involved in any of this. I'm just recounting the stories that have been to me. But I suppose someone with a bit of perception, a bit of foresight, realised that whilst this in itself is a terrible incident, and there were two criminal convictions that came from that, following it to the perpetrators of the actual violence. But whilst it was a terrible incident, somebody recognised it was actually an opportunity to engage this group. And so what they did is they brought together a team around, if you like, of professionals at the school and supporting agencies, looked at the individuals who were involved, the parents were brought to the school, and in the end they had this enormous group where they talked about, like I say, I wasn't there to witness it yet. Or was it winking? They obviously brought this team together and engaged that whole group of young people, and through that the issues were dealt with, as the victim issues, their own, because I'm sure that those young people, because you know that is, whilst young people are heavily demonised, that is not your average behaviour for young people. It just isn't. You know, most young kids are well behaved and just getting on with life, looking for a bit of fun. They're naturally attracted to stuff and might get into trouble by being too near to it, but generally they're not willfully engaged in criminal or antisocial behaviour. So there will have been concerns about those young people anyway, and some of them will have been passengers, some of them would have been drivers in that whole incident. But what this opportunity did, it afforded them the chance to address a whole raft of things. And as it was said to me, the young woman who was the victim was given a significant boost by this whole experience, and she was able to work through the feelings that she was planning on secreting from anybody, clearly, for 4 months on. It wasn't started, the process started. So I think from a suppose a group, I call it a group offence, that. From a group context, the group would then address, and I think through a mediation, well, no, I mean, it wasn't even mediation, it was restorative justice, really. On a school, quite really hard about it, don't you? But by, in, within a school context, and enabled by the school, I think criminal justice agencies were involved, but took a back seat, if you like, and just risk-proofed it and enabled the school to work through the presenting issues from the actual offence itself to all the other bits and pieces went around it. So that is a really good piece of work. From
how long did it take? Was it one session?
No, I don't think it was one session, I think it was several. I think what also happened, I think from the original session, there will have been then like a tiered approach to it, because there will have been more acute presenting issues with some of those individuals, and they would have required probably more one-to-one work later on. But it started, if you like, they were brought together for a group element of it, and I think there were several sessions that took place.
Group therapy thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It existed for a long time, isn't it?
It did, yeah.
It's not a new perspective.
It's how not. What I'm talking about here is, well, they were the group of perpetrators. They weren't just individual people suffering with
yeah,
that.
I get what you're
most
saying.
Offender groups.
Crime committed collectively.
Yeah.
And the process is collective.
But it's different. There's a different dynamic at play there.
Yeah.
So.
It's funny, in the work that I do, we do co-design. So we work with the community to design things and processes, but isn't that what restorative justice is? It's a co-design process, because it's not just being facilitated.
Are you asking me or are you telling me?
No, I don't know, I'm asking.
Then I won't answer that.
Yeah. What do you think? Because that seems to me to have a sort of co-design but slightly led element, so that the group can co-design the remedy. Is that
I don't think it was co-design. No, I don't think it was that, because right. I think the people that brought the group together led that and identified the issue, but facilitated the young people's opportunity to discuss it. I'm sure they built on it, and I'm sure that becomes part of it. But when you with younger people, you still need to have that. They still need a steer. They still need to have those, and they need to be given permission to articulate as well. They don't necessarily have the words to use or the understanding. They have the experiences, but they might necessarily have the ability to identify them in the way that we would.
I think one of the elements that hasn't been mentioned today, which I think would probably be a tool in the dynamic of those young people, is shame. And by bringing their parents in, is the shame that their parents would feel, and that realisation when you see their child with those things just from school exhibiting that sort of behaviour. And that's a very powerful tool within restorative justice.
So it is, yeah.
It's the young person's own shame without realising what they did. But the impact might actually be the shame expressed by someone who's important to them. So it's a
not the victim shame.
They may have no feeling for the victim.
Yeah.
They may have no feeling for what they've done. But then family members important to them says, I'm absolutely ashamed of what you've done. And it's that relationship that they now feel affected triggers some insight into they've actually done something wrong.
Yeah.
And then they start to open up, because that relationship with that person is something that's important in their lives. The rest of it may not be. And then they can start the road of trying to understand. So it's a different dynamic, potentially.
Yeah.
The person working in to try and draw out what's the ingredient with that person or that group. And if they're part of a community, then they live in the community. So those young people go to school in a community of which parents will know each other, and there's a kind of joint shame between the parents.
Mm-hmm.
But other parents then know that their child was involved in an offence, and then we're shopping together. Do you know what I mean? This is
almost an informal version of what you're talking about, isn't it? This is kind of about co-design, because within that there's lots of values at play that are operating between those people.
I heard the police say the mothers are very important, and like the shame things about mum usually. But I think what you're saying is interesting. I've just thought a bit more, and I think that group work, group therapy, is usually a group of strangers being facilitated. And what you're saying, I can't think of anything that I've read that it's about a group that are connecting. That's
yeah.
a different tool.
That's what you're about to a degree.
Yeah.
That's what we're looking at, and that's what
yeah,
we're. But we want to talk to you guys about this. Yeah. Listen, we have to finish, and I'm really sorry, but I feel like we've just started to get into some. Thank you for that. That was a really good point, and. Yeah, we will. Yeah, I suppose from my point of view, and take your own learning from this, but from a message point of view, I guess the issue that I started with around gangs and the context of gangs and what gangs are, it's just I think it's don't be such a ready sort of recipient of the feed that comes from you know the agenda on that. I think we need to challenge it. And it's something we've learned, isn't it, through the Any Gang Any Violence peer review, is that areas need to be very clear. About what they are saying is a gang and what isn't. I know it's not an exact science, it's clearly I've presented it to be a very opposite to that, it's quite a complicated issue, but because of that we need to proceed very cautiously, but there are things to draw from this. I think
one of the things I've been looking at is oral history. So when people engage in oral history, they usually see themselves as criminals. That's quite a big thing. But if you were to do a collective history with them, try to take story down, I wonder if it's a different way of doing therapy. I wonder what would happen. Do you see what I mean? I wonder if that is a way of seeing what is the dynamic. Because surely what the role of facilitation is to, I suppose, identify the unfairness and inequality of the relationships within the gang as well as the victims.
Yeah.
And so that to me, I find quite an interesting. There's no word I can put it in my head. But
Just what's come to mind, just finish on really, and it's the opposite to the shame. I was at Risley Prison a few weeks ago for a meeting, and I was talking to a couple of the information officers who were kind of keeping tabs on some of our quite significant gang members from Manchester, and there was one who was in prison at the same time for the same offence, but he was put in a Cat V prison. And his co-defendant, or his co-accused, or co-convictee, was put in a Cat A prison. And he was disgusted by this. And he wanted to be in a Cat A prison because he realised that was where he should, that was his rightful place. And it's bizarre. You know, we have this with Mapper. What level Mapper are you? 1 and 2. And we hear this. Why am I not a level 3 Mapper? So-and-so's level 3 Mapper. Like, and they get some status from these strange labels that we've given them. You know, I don't know if they should be talking about Mapper with him in the first place. But there's this, but that's the opposite side of that. It's like the opposite to shame, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the slapping as well, where they show each other.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that there's a significant other.
Oh gosh,
if
yeah.
they're brought into the group, it changes that whole subculture.
Starting below the line, shame.
And I think it's finding where shame is, and that's what the police say. The police that I work with, they say that it's usually the mother. Yeah. Seems to be a bit obvious.
I mean, a lot of work that we do in the alternative community is with families, so we have a dedicated family worker who works with every single family who comes through the door, and they nominate their significant person in their life, whether that's mum or the brother or cousin, and we start to work with them to get some sensible dynamic within the family home. A lot of information we get from there is crucial, and sometimes in terms of managing risk, we find things out from the family that we wouldn't have found out anyway.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.